Chapter 15, in Dwaraka. Jarasandha attacks. Asti and Prapti, Kamsa's widows, feeling dispossessed, left Mathura and went back to their parents in distress. Jarasandha, their father, ruler of the Magadha state, was furious to hear about his daughter's husband's fate. Jarasandha, a powerful and cruel wicked man, announced, "I vow to rid the world of Krishna and his clan." Then, feeling sure his troops would quickly smash the opposition, he launched a siege of Mathura with 23 divisions. When they saw this attacking army swelling like a sea, the citizens of Mathura felt great anxiety. Though Krishna saw conditions he could easily adjust, he comes for certain reasons, so he started thinking thus. "So many soldiers, chariots, and elephants have come. I'm here to lift earth's burdens, and this force is surely one. They all shall die, but I shall free Jarasandha, for then he'll go away and recreate his army once again. I save those who are pious and destroy those who are not, so I shall end this army and the suffering they've wrought. In other days, in other ways, in other sites and climes, I've vanquished irreligion when it flares from time to time." At once, two golden transcendental chariots appeared, complete with horses, drivers, shields, and military gear. His chakra in his hand and golden helmet on his head, Lord Krishna called for Balaram and courteously said, "Respected elder brother, your dependents need your help. Your chariot and weapons are awaiting your good self. Remove those evil soldiers from this planet, if you please, for, after all, we've come to earth to save our devotees." Resplendent in their armor, and without a moment's wait, the brothers and 100 men rode past the city gates. Although his force was tiny, Krishna's mighty conch shell blast alarmed Jarasandha and the divisions he'd amassed. Jarasandha looked mockingly at Krishna and declared, "I will not fight with you, mere boy, for that would be unfair. You killed your uncle Kamsa. Go away, you craven fool. Now, Balaram, if you're not scared, I'll fight you in a duel." Said Krishna, "Heroes never boast. They simply show their skill. You speak deceits like these to ease your fear of being killed." And then, as dust obscures a flame, or clouds obscure the sun, the army circled Krishna's troops, 4,000 men to one. When Krishna was surrounded and, from all appearance, doomed, the women, looking on from Mathura, felt faint and swooned. The archers of Jarasandha fired arrows by the score, so Krishna drew his fabled bow, which all the gods adore. Lord Krishna's arrows, razor sharp, became an endless blaze that slaughtered men on horse and foot who rushed him from all ways. The horses, men, and elephants fell dead in great surprise as Krishna's arrow split their heads and sliced their arms and thighs. The severed necks and limbs of man and beast released their blood, which grew into a current that became a crimson flood. That bloody river's snakes were arms, its turtles severed heads, and islands formed where elephants lay in that river, dead. The hands and thighs appeared like fish, the human hair like weeds. Abandoned bows were ripples, other weapons brush and reeds. The floating wheels of chariots revolved like swirling pools. The gravel in that bloody stream was ornaments and jewels. The flow of blood, which shocked those souls who watched with timid eyes, aroused a sense of great relief and joy among the wise. Lord Krishna used his arrows, and Lord Balaram his plow, and neither showed a speck of perspiration on their brows. Why should one be surprised when God annihilates his foes? For he creates and dictates all, as everybody knows. Though Krishna has no need to fight, no kingdom to be gained, his actions can attract lost souls, as sages have explained. Jarasandha's great army was completely put to death. Jarasandha was caught and bound, the only demon left. But Krishna ordered him released. He had a plan to fill. So Balaram untied his ropes, obliging Krishna's will. Jarasandha, once highly honored, trudged away in shame and pledged himself to penance to restore his tarnished name. But then his friends persuaded him that he should fight again. They said, "Your loss is just the cost one pays for former sins." Lord Krishna entered Mathura. He hadn't lost a man. The gods tossed fragrant flowers and a festival began. The people, freed of fearlessness and ready to rejoice, cheered loud and long as bards raised song in strong, proficient voice. As conches blared and kettle drums laid down a booming beat, the citizens strung banners and splashed perfume in the streets. The flutes and veenas sweetly played as priests sang Vedic hymns, and everyone felt happier than they had ever been. The women gazed at Krishna with affection-laden eyes and showered him with garlands, blooms, and freshly toasted rice. The Lord, whose glance had liberated all the slaughtered men, presented Ugrasen, the king, with piles of captured gems. Again Jarasandha assembled soldiers by the score, but Krishna cut down every one just as he'd done before. And still another 15 times the fool launched vain attacks, and as the soldiers fell, the overburdened earth relaxed. Constructing Dwarka. As Krishna's plan unfurled and ran precisely on its course, Jarasandha began to build another fighting force. However, Kalayavana, a beast, arrived there first, with soldiers by the millions to turn Mathura to dirt. Lord Krishna said to Balaram about this latest threat, "An ancient curse upon the Yadus has this rogue upset. Jarasandha could come while Kalayavana attacks and steal or kill our relatives behind our very backs. We must construct a fortress that will keep away these beasts so everyone in Mathura again can live in peace. We'll call this fortress Dwarka. I'll set it up tonight. We'll relocate our citizens, then come back here to fight." Lord Balaram agreed in full, so Krishna instantly produced a fort 100 miles wide within the sea. We couldn't float a single stone, but Krishna's God. As such, he floats the stars and planets, so for him, this wasn't much. This fortress, known as Dwarka, stood tall and bright and grand. Broad avenues surrounded public parks on ample land that boasted fragrant trees and vines the demigods supplied, along with golden gates and spires that seemed to touch the sky. The houses, too, were made of gold, with emeralds for floors, fine gem-encrusted crowns, and golden pots outside their doors. The dwellings were luxurious for every rank and class, with watchtowers and temple rooms and stables made of brass. Lord Krishna's many palaces lined clean, enormous streets. The gods each brought a certain gift to make the fort complete. From heaven, Indra brought a Parijata tree and the Sudharma meeting hall, where all gained immortality. Varuna offered horses of a most distinctive kind, with varied hues, both white and blue, and swifter than the mind. Kuvera gave 8 mystic gifts, assuring all of wealth, and other gods and goddesses gave richly of themselves. The people went to sleep in Mathura that mystic night, and woke up in their rich new homes, amazed in great delight. And meanwhile, Balaram and Krishna planned new strategies to end the threat designed and set by these two enemies. The death of Kalayavana. That morning, Kalayavana's enormous, brutish force saw Krishna exit Mathura, without a bow or horse. They seethed to see that Krishna held them in such low respect that he would walk outside unarmed, a garland on his neck. When Kalayavana saw Krishna nonchalant and bold, he noted how his enemy was pleasant to behold. The Lord's dark blue complexion and his eyes tinged to lotus pink made Kalayavana look twice, stand still, and crudely think, "This Krishna has the mark known as Sri Vatsa on his chest. The famed Kaustubha gem hangs on his neck. He has the rest of Vishnu's special qualities, as Narada describes. But he's insulted me, so I shall tear him up alive." So Kalayavana threw down his weapons on the spot and dashed off after Krishna, sure he'd easily be caught. Lord Krishna turned and ran away, the fiend in hot pursuit, a fool absorbed in hope to apprehend the Absolute. Remaining just beyond the range of every grasp he gave, Lord Krishna guided Kalayavana inside a cave. The fiend cried, "Stop, you coward! Now your reputation's stained!" But he could not catch Krishna, for his karma still remained. Lord Krishna ran inside the cave, ignoring these remarks. When Kalayavana ran in, he stumbled in the dark upon a man who lay at rest and gave him no regard. "He runs, lies down and hides," the demon cried, and kicked him hard. The sleeping man was someone else who'd long been resting there. He lifted heavy eyelids, looked about, and grew aware of Kalayavana, who stood by staring unabashed. Those sleepy eyes fell on the demon, burning him to ash. King Vishnurata, listening for hours without a word, at once put forth this question after hearing what occurred. Who was this man who lived in caves and yet was so adept that he could burn to ashes one who woke him when he slept? Said Sukadev, "This man, named Muchakunda, was renowned as one who cared for Brahmins and who always kept his vow. He once enjoyed a kingdom, but he set his throne aside when Indra came to him and begged, 'The gods are terrified. The demons have attacked us, and we fear they may succeed. Since you are the strongest mortal king and famous for your deeds, take up your sword and lead our forces. When the war is through, the gods will do whatever you may wish for them to do.' He fought for years, till Shiva's son took charge of heaven's troops. The gods said, 'Muchakunda, you have been most resolute. Since we no longer need you, we release you from your vow. And so if you want a benediction, ask it of us now. You set aside a kingdom that was strong and unopposed, and selflessly took up the heavy task that we proposed. Because you went to heaven, though, to stop the demons' crimes, your children, queens, and friends have died. They lived on mortal time. A minute passed in heaven is a year for earthly men. Yet even here, the hand of God, as time, will do us in. Now take your choice of boons from us to savor while you live, except for liberation, which the Lord alone can give.' 'If that's the case,' said Muchakunda, 'what could I desire? My kingdom's gone, I fought so long, and I've become so tired that all I can look forward to is long and peaceful rest. So this, O gods, shall be the benediction I request. Allow me to remain asleep for days or weeks or years, as long as I may wish. And if someone interferes, let's say a god in peril, who implores me to return, a glance from my awakened eyes will make that person burn.' The gods could understand that Muchakunda wanted peace. They granted his bizarre request and gave him his release. So Muchakunda found a spot where he would never wake till foolish Kalayavana performed his last mistake. Then Krishna, who knew all of this, revealed his splendid form before King Muchakunda, who was instantly transformed. Astonished by the beautiful effulgence he displayed, The pious king stared straight at Krishna, shook his head, and prayed, "Who are you? Why have such soft feet traversed this thorny ground? Are you Lord Indra, Chandra, Agni, someone more renowned? You must be God himself, for in this cave, as dark as night, the luster of your body has filled everything with light." The king explained his story and the vow he undertook, and said, "Your luster stuns me. I can scarcely bear to look. My lord, please tell me of yourself, if that would be allowed." Lord Krishna, pleased, replied in words as deep as rumbling clouds, "Dear king, my births are thousands, and my names the same amount. In fact, I've had more births and names than even I can count. If one could count earth's particles of dust on hands and knees, he'd still not count my births or names, my deeds or qualities. Great sages list my present, past, and future deeds, dear friend. Despite their patient efforts, they have never reached the end. Some time ago, Brahma requested me to save the earth, so I became the son of Vasudeva and took this birth. Through me, Pralamba, Kamsa, and their kind met their demise. Now you've burned Kalayavana, this demon, with your eyes. Since in the past, repeatedly, you've offered prayers to me, I've met you in this cave, for I'm inclined to devotees. My dear and saintly Muchukunda, take some blessing, please. I'll give you anything you ask, and put your mind at ease. If someone somehow satisfies and proves himself to me, he'll never need again lament or suffer misery." On hearing this, the king bowed down, his forehead to the ground. Sage Garga had foretold he'd see the Lord, and now he found the Lord himself had come to him in such a perfect way. Rejoicing in his fortune, Muchukunda gently prayed, "My Lord, the men and women of this world are most confused by your divine illusions. Thus they fail to worship you. Oblivious to their own good, they build up families that fail to bring them happiness and cause them miseries. A soul who squanders human life, forgetting you, will dwell within some mortal home as if a beast trapped in a well. Intoxicated by my wealth, my wives, and my domain, I thought myself this mortal flesh and suffered endless pain. I arrogantly raised an army, roamed the earth, and thought my body was eternal, though it's obviously not. A greedy fool like me ignores you till you come at last as death, a hungry snake devouring blind and helpless rats. A body riding elephants or chariots of gold is called the king and flaunted for the public to behold. And then your endless form of time renames that royal corpse as feces, worms, or ashes, when its lifetime runs its course. I conquered all directions. When my splendid throne was raised, my former enemies bowed down before me and gave praise. But when I went to see my queen, my sovereignty was gone, and I became her pet, a helpless beast to be led on. A king desiring happiness performs austerity and overcomes his self-important, proud mentality. When one stops chasing matter, he may meet your devotee and gain a realization of your true supremacy. To see you here has ended my affection for my throne. A wise king leaves his empire for the woods and lives alone. Devotees serve your lotus feet. Please let me do the same. Why should I ask a boon that brings entanglement and pain? Henceforward, I renounce those things I used to want to do. Relieved of such attachments, may I now depend on you? You have no designations. You are undiluted proof that nature, goodness, darkness, passion, can't obscure the truth. My senses can't be satisfied. They'll never give me peace. I'm trapped and burning in this world and cannot gain release. Protect me, Lord. This world is just a dangerous masquerade. To serve your lotus feet will make me pleased and unafraid." The Lord replied, Great ruler, you've a clear and potent mind. You could have taken any boon from me, were you inclined. I offered you some blessing, just to prove that you are pure. The honor of my unalloyed devotees is secure. Though yogis master breathing drills, their inner mental state remains a site for sensual desire to incubate. Your mind has no such problem. It is simply fixed on me. Now wander where you will with your unfailing loyalty. Because you were a Kshatriya, you've killed both man and beast, incurring many sins from which you now must be released. Perform your penance in this life, and surely in the next, you'll come back as a Brahmin and achieve complete success. King Muchakunda honored Krishna, left the cave, and smiled. Of course, he had not been outside at all in quite a while. The Kali Age has come, the monarch quickly realized. The people, beasts, and trees he saw had shrunk in rank and size. The sober king was firm and transcendental. Going forth, he reached Bhadarik Ashrama in the distant, frigid north. He worshipped Lord Narayan and remained there peacefully in constant thought of Krishna through severe austerity.